Today's episode is brought to you by the eCommerce Fuel Private Community, the most vibrant and active discussion forum for owners of seven and eight-figure e-commerce businesses. So how is it any different from other communities online or DTC Twitter? Three big reasons. First, it's vetted. Everyone inside owns a seven or eight-figure business. Average member does about $5 million top line per year. About 15% are doing it with eight figures. You get advice from the owners who have actually been there in the trenches and that you know you can trust it because we vetted them and they're actually doing what they say they are. Secondly, no pitching. There's no affiliate links, no vendors hawking stuff at you. This is just real operators sharing what's working. And then finally, reciprocity is one of our biggest values when we moderate. We require that everyone shares something when they come in so you learn from them, but also we don't let people just come in and strip mine the community for information so you get a really healthy dynamic group. So confident this will be a game changer for your business that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. Join the community, stay for a year, and if you don't see 10x the value relative to your membership fees, we'll refund all of them plus give you $1,000 just for the hassle. So if it sounds interesting, check us out. We'd love to have you apply, and you can learn more at ecommercefuel.com. The eCommerce Fuel podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the largest and most popular upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 Shopify Plus stores. Man, it is hard to get people to your store these days, whether you're doing organic or whether you're trying to get down in the muck that is Facebook ads these days with the disaster that that has become. You want to take advantage when people actually show up. And if you give people a chance, one in six will spend more money with you if you send them a personalized, targeted, relevant upsell offer, which is what one-click upsell makes it super easy to do. You can do it pre-purchase, post-purchase, give them lots of different options. It makes it incredibly easy. And they've helped store owners generate over $200 million in additional revenue. So if you want a slice of that, and you want to get started, you can get started really quickly with them in just a few minutes. Get your first upsell up and running. Check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the eCommerce Fuel podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And about 18 months ago, the e-commerce M&A market fell off of a cliff, more or less. It was probably May, June, right around in there. And for a number of reasons, activity came to a screeching halt. And here we are, you know, at the beginning of 2024. I wanted to check in and see what are things looking like out there. There's actually a couple instances in the last month or two where I needed to get some ballpark valuations on companies. And I tend to have a pretty good pulse on these, but for the first time in a while, I had to do some digging because it's been such an unusual time. And so not everyone is thinking about selling their company imminently, but it's always something that people are interested in. If you're listening and have a company, you're always curious to know what it's worth. And so joining me today to talk about all these things is Emmett Kilduff. He's the co-founder and CEO of the Fortea Group, which is a lower to mid-market investment bank focused on e-commerce companies doing between $2 to $200 million in revenue. And we're going to geek out about all things M&A, where the markets are going, kind of how fundraising is looks, what the future might look like, Thrasio's kind of implosion, how that impacts things, and where there's opportunity potentially this year. So Emmett, thank you for being willing to come on. Excited to talk about this because, man, it's not a clear space right now.
Great to be here, Andrew. Yeah, where do we start? There's lots to talk about, lots to dig in.
Yeah, maybe we can start with, can you give us the lay of the land with the M&A market right now? Like, what is it? Are we still on kind of just in the doldrums? Is activity picking up a little bit? Like, what's kind of the pulse of the M&A market for e-com right now?
Well, you know, to your earlier point, I think the top of the market was like Q4 2021. That's when we saw the crazy valuations, particularly maybe more so in FBA than DTC, given all the aggregators like the Thrasios of the world and supply-demand imbalance in terms of deals and valuations. So that was the peak in terms of volumes and valuations. Last year, volumes were very low, as in 2023, volumes were very low. Valuations have improved ever so slightly, maybe, compared to 2022. And look, we see an uptick in 2024 in terms of volumes and a small uptick in valuations. We won't get back to the lofty heights of Q4 2021. So please, you know, don't entrepreneurs have to be somewhat realistic when they're going to market. You know, it'll be hard to get back there given, you know, the COVID bump, etc. And I mean, what we're seeing from, you know, big bulge bracket Wall Street banks that I used to work for, like Morgan Stanley and others, their outlook for 2024 are all certainly more positive than it was for 2023. So that bodes well. You know, the S&P, the markets are doing quite well. Interest rates look like they're coming down. Inflation is a bit of under control. That gives investors, acquirers more confidence as they come back from the holidays, as they came back from the holidays. And, you know, that's good for deal doing. I've lived through a few of these cycles, the dot-com boom and bust about 20 years ago, the credit crunch about 15 years ago. And look, it's going to come back. It's just a matter of time. These are all cycles. So patience is important for entrepreneurs.
What are you seeing, maybe specifically talking multiples? So multiples of EBITDA, and maybe you can bracket it, because I know that they're going to vary based on the size of the business in terms of its earnings and profitability. But beginning of 2024, can you give people a sense of what things are selling for? Maybe in the under $1 million of maybe seller's discretionary earning. Maybe we could go 500K if a business is selling for 500K, maybe 2 million in EBITDA, and maybe, you know, even 5 million in EBITDA, something like that. And granted, there's huge caveat. There's so many variables here, but if you can give ranges, that would be, I think, helpful for folks. And I'm curious as well.
Yeah. The typical range today, what we're seeing for profitable DTC brands that have some growth, at least some revenue growth, is between 4X and 12X EBITDA. Now, that's typical range. I need to give some caveats so people don't just, you know, print that. There's distressed brands that are pricing way below 4X, right? You know, we're a shareholder in the Hedgehog Company, one of the only aggregators of distressed DTC brands, and the multiples they pay are very, very low. And there are exceptions to the upside. I heard of a pet business recently that sold for 30x EBITDA. But broadly, for the sizes you're talking about there, Andrew, we would say it's in the 4x to 12x range. How do you get to the high end of that range? You need to be in great categories like pets, baby, beauty, where there's a lot of demand at the moment. You need to have, you know, high revenue growth, ideally lots of subscription revenue, if not all subscription revenue. If you don't have that, you know, high repeat purchase rate, great net margin, you know, some of the usual characteristics. That's what helps you get from the 4x to the 12x, as well as a competitive auction, which, you know, a firm like the Fortea Group is accustomed to organizing.
Yeah. Let me give you, if you would, let me paint you just a real high level picture of a brand, and maybe you can give me a rough range. Let's say this, you get a company that's doing, let's say they're doing 8 million in revenue. Let's say they've got 15% net margins, net profit margins or EBITDA margins. So they get 1.2 million in profits per year. They're growing, let's say 15 to 20% top line and profitability wise. So not razor hot, but kind of just slow, consistent growth. They've been around for, let's say, 7 years. Let's say they're in not really subscription revenue. Most of it, no subscription revenue. 60% on their own website, 40% Amazon. They have a proprietary product of their own. It's not patented, but they have their own brand that people know. Something like that. That's a kind of a profile that would fit a lot of people in our community, I think. What would something like that be trading for if you were going to go through a competitive process, which I also want to talk about that versus kind of the standard listing approach? What would a ballpark range for the multiple on that, a business like that, be?
Yeah, well, thank you for putting me under lots of pressure. I like pressure. We priced something similar, broadly similar to that earlier this year for 7.1x EBITDA. The revenue would have been a little bit smaller. It wasn't as established, but the other metrics were relatively similar. So this is a little bit better than that. So I would give a range, and bear in mind that was April 2013. So that's like 8 months ago. As we get into, say, Q1 2024, there'll be a little, you know, just general uptick. So I would give a range of, I'd give a range of 6 to 9x for that type of business.
See, that seems much stronger than I would have expected. Just kind of, and again, from you have much more data points and are more informed in this area. So that's really encouraging to me. I would have guessed that would have been a 4.5 to maybe 5.5 or 4.5 to 6 kind of thing. So that's encouraging.
So then the devil's in the details. So the range I give includes upfront and deferred components of consideration. And right now, the deferred components are a larger part of the overall consideration than they were maybe 1 to 2 years ago. So, you won't get 100% upfront in the bank, right? You'll get a percentage today on exit and a percentage deferred. And the devil's in the detail in terms of deferred consideration and earnouts, etc. And we can get into that if you'd like. The other point that we probably should have categorized is what category was that brand in? If it's in pets, baby, beauty, it's going to have a better chance of getting a higher multiple.
Yeah, it is. The big thing that people were chasing, a couple of years ago is growth, as is in often the case in periods of euphoria and bubbles. Just get big, grow the top line. VCs are just shoveling money at companies that are going fast. Who cares about profitability? It's like that, that Silicon Valley skit where it's like, listen, you don't want to have revenues. Revenues are, then you have to show a profit. Like, we're just an idea, man. Idea is what is important here. So we swift, of course, the paradigm has switched dramatically. Is profitability the new growth? Is that what really is attracting buyers these days?
Yeah, I think for last year, we've been definitely advising entrepreneurs to focus on the bottom line. The public markets are the same. There's some great posts by a guy called Ben Kogan who works for Agora Brands, a DTC aggregator. He writes brilliant posts on this topic on LinkedIn for those who want to follow him. And he tracks, companies that are public and other e-com companies. He tracks the whole, issue of the VCs maybe not investing as much in DTC post the iOS changes 2 years ago. And so, yeah, look, I've seen this in three cycles now. After the dot-com boom, after the credit crunch, now people are focused more on the bottom line. But guess what's going to happen? Despite all our learnings, in at some point in the future, people are going to want to chase growth again. But maybe e-com has learned a lesson. It's not about raising as much VC as possible and chasing growth at all costs and meta, winning. It needs to be a bit more prudent, profitable growth. And that might be the way future successful brands, end up coming about. I think in this environment, you need to protect your business and make sure it survives. And for nothing else, forget what external people think or want. Focus on the bottom line. So you have cash. Revenue is vanity. Profit is sanity. Cash is king.
You mentioned, you have some strong thoughts as any banker worth their salt would on getting the maximum value for your clients when they go to sell. And you see, I'm always so interested in people who sit in positions like you do, where you can have x-ray vision into companies. Commercial bankers have the same kind of thing. And what do you see among founders that leads to really great outcomes? And it could be something that's either, maybe both actually, in terms of either their personality or their traits or how they run their business, but then also in terms of how they run or go through a sale process.
I think, bear in mind, I've come from big M&A at Morgan Stanley, but like every listed company, every S&P or NASDAQ company, when they think about an exit, they start planning 1 to 2 years out. And I've been frustrated by the lack of planning by e-com entrepreneurs, more so FBA entrepreneurs, because generally, with all due respect, they're more mom and pops with some VAs. DTC are more like real companies with org charts and they've had to raise funding. But even still, a lot of DTC entrepreneurs I've met don't have boards, don't have a panel of advisors, don't have any mentors. That's crazy. I've always looked for a mentor in my personal life and my professional life. I have boards on all my companies. It's fantastic to bounce off ideas. I think it's crazy that even a small DTC business doing 10 million doesn't have boards of advisors. I mean, they don't have to be formal directors with directors' duties and responsibilities. They can be informal advisory panel members. But I would say there's an entrepreneur on the call today that's got a pet business in a niche, let's say it's treats. I would encourage that person, him or her, to go find someone who's made it in that category, give them some share options and get them on as an advisor so they don't make the same mistake. So what I'm trying to say, Andrew, is fail to prepare, prepare to fail. From an exit process perspective, start thinking 1 to 2 years out. And the second point is, please get some advisors, mentors. I'm not saying by any means corporate finance advisors. I'm saying proven entrepreneurs are folks that have been there, done that. and get them on your team so that you don't make the mistakes and you know, when the fork in the road comes, you make the right choice.
Yeah. You mentioned Thrasio, and I think a lot of people know, but if you're not, for those who aren't aware, I think Thrasio, a big aggregator, raised billions of dollars in capital and just recently filed for bankruptcy. Is that, how has that changed the market? Obviously, it's been a hard, much harder FBA market in general, but are you seeing that news have even further impacts on the FBA market these days?
Well, let's just take a step back for a second, right? So if anyone on this podcast built a business that acquired 100 brands in 2021, 2022, at the top of the market with all the demand and pricing and high valuations, like, we would all be in trouble, right? Just like any retailer in the States over the last 50 years that got into trouble, they hired restructuring advisors, right? JCPenney, lots of companies that hired restructuring advisors. There was nothing new to that. They needed some help. They filed for bankruptcy. Let's see what happens to the business, the operations, the brands. I think let's watch this space for now. Equoco, Benetago were two others that had issues. And bear in mind, for your listeners, they're all mainly FBA aggregators. They're not DTC aggregators, who I think have learned the lessons of the FBA early adopters. Sometimes the innovators can get shot, and everything went against them. But what's frustrating to me, Andrew, to come at the question from a different perspective, is the press only talk about the bad news, the bad stories. There's lots of aggregators that are profitable, FBA aggregators and DTC aggregators, profitable at the corporate EBITDA level, that are doing well, particularly ones that are niche. So those aggregators that tried to buy across all categories and geographies, that was always going to be tough, right? You're a jack of all trades, experts at none. And those that have focused in on niches, a lot of them are doing very well. I hope the press catch up, pick up on that. We're doing a merger of two aggregators at the moment we're advising on, which we'll announce, scheduled to announce in mid-January at our New York conference. And, that's a positive news for this space as opposed to just negative news. But, and then bear in mind that, again, if you're over 10 million revenue, you've earned the right to pitch to those other two buckets, the private equity firms and the strategics. Remember, 5 years ago, there were no aggregators in this world, e-commerce aggregators. So it's back to normal. There's plenty of people to exit to. And frankly, they typically pay higher multiples. So, everyone gets caught up in this whole aggregator thing, but it's relatively new anyway. I've been doing M&A for nearly 25 years, and I didn't hear of Thrasio up until 3 years ago.
You mentioned some of the aggregators that are making a really good go of it, especially the niche ones. Can you name a couple of them as examples? It's just interesting, partially from just curiosity and partially if people are listening, thinking, it might be a good fit down the road for someone who's executing really well on that side, who's doing it really well.
So, like the obvious name that often, some names that come to mind in the FBA world, just to like for Thrasio, would be Gravatique, focuses on medical and healthcare. You have Intrinsic in the States, focuses now, they were healthcare and they've gone even nicher. They've gone female healthcare. So, uber niche. And they will likely own that space. So there's two examples. If you're a female health tech aggregator and you speak to female health tech entrepreneurs, the connection's brilliant. You understand them. You understand exactly what they're up to. You can really resonate. You can entrust them and convince them that you'll take their business, their baby, from here to there. And so, there's a lot of rationale for that instead of being all things to all people. And if I was launching an aggregator, I would focus on a specific niche and, take it from there.
Yeah. What kind of deal flow in terms of maybe what's the trend in deal flow you're seeing in terms of distressed companies? I'm sure you have every week you have people come that want to sell and you've got to tell them, hey, I'm in decline, and you've probably got to get them some pretty bad news. This is worth way less than you probably think if felt sellable at all. Are you seeing a tick up in that for kind of over the last 12 months? One of my theories, we did a predictions episode for 2024, 2-3 weeks ago. And one of my predictions was that in 2024, we're finally going to see a lot of the stuff that's been baked in, maybe some slower spending demand, maybe interest rates higher, just some difficulties catch up with brands and starting to see kind of more distressed deals and people, names that go under. So is that something you're playing out and seeing? And do you think that's going to continue in 2024?
100% it's going to continue. It's probably going to get worse before it gets better. There's lots of distress. Again, ever since those iOS changes 2 years ago, like a lot of VCs have not been following their money on their existing portfolio companies, are not investing new money into e-com. It's really tough. And it gets to the whole point of the ability of e-com entrepreneurs to raise equity. The equity markets are pretty much shut right now, even for really good businesses. So that's, and the debt markets are also tough. So that leads to distress. There's a funding, issue at the moment. We don't advise distressed companies. And here's why. It's incredibly hard to make a market. I touched on Hedgehog earlier on. That's one great buyer of distressed DTC businesses. There are not 100 hedgehogs. So as an intermediary, as an advisor, I can't be in the middle there, helping the entrepreneur find the best deal. It's really tough. And I think it's going to get tougher, because you can imagine lots of entrepreneurs were scrambling this, in 2023 to find more equity, to find more debt, and maybe they've hit a brick wall and they go into 2024 with a cash runway that's, getting shorter and shorter. And some of them, when we speak to them, and I say this honestly, rather than trying to raise equity, I think a more realistic route crystallizing shareholder value is a two-step exit. So, you can spend 9 months trying to raise equity and good luck. It's incredibly unlikely to succeed. Do a two-step exit where you either sell a portion of your business today or you sell it in the entire bit today and there's conditions. So say, for example, you sell 40% today and you agree to sell the balance over maybe two tranches if certain terms are hit. At least then, you get two bites of the apple or three bites of the apple. You get to retain some of the upside with hard shares. I'm personally not a big fan on earnouts if you can avoid it, but keeping hard shares and having, a clear way to monetize that can be much more likely than trying to raise equity. Now, that doesn't suit everybody. Like, most PE firms will want control on day one and so on. You need to find the right investor stroke acquirer, but it's something to think about.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Daniel, the owner of dayspringpens.com, where they sell, not shockingly, pens and pen accessories. Daniel's an incredibly kind and gracious guy, was hugely helpful in terms of helping people with the lay of the land at our recent, or not so recent, Norfolk event for ECF Live. But here's what he had to say about his experience with E-commerce Fuel, our private invented community for 7- and 8-figure owners.
E-commerce Fuel was one of the first forums or communities for entrepreneurs that I found out about when I switched over from my original career into e-commerce and business. And I didn't know it at the time, but it very quickly would become a true north for me and the business, where every business decision that I would make, every strategic decision for advancement or growth, it was a place that I could go and rely on the wisdom of the forum. And that trust has just been huge and has helped grow the business over time. So over the last 4 years, we've more than doubled in size from a top-line perspective in our business. We've done things like replatform on Shopify, grow content marketing, engage AI to like leverage, reduce labor costs, all the way down to personal finance, things like credit card reward hacking, tax strategies, things that enhance not just the business, but also as an owner, they help me strategically engage with my family life and my personal life in a way that I wasn't sure was ever possible when I was first getting started. You'd be very hard-pressed to find a group of more engaged, thoughtful, and expert individuals than you do at E-commerce Fuel, and I'm exceedingly grateful for being a part of the community.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7- or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Where do you see opportunity this coming year? I mean, we've got 2024, valuations are starting to get a little higher. There's still a lot of distressed. It's kind of the public markets, although I tell you what, we're recording this, it'll be a couple of weeks until we, if not touch more before we release this, and the public markets have a real great skill for totally flipping on you when you make statements about them in between recording and publication time. But public markets, as of now, seem like they're, you know, hitting new highs on the in the Dow. Economically, we seem like we've avoided some things. Where do you see opportunity for store owners, but also investors? Investors could be equity, it could be debt, it could be, and particularly too, not necessarily, if you could put your hat on, not necessarily thinking through like private, you know, private equity or institutional investors, but think about someone who's maybe got a, you know, an e-commerce entrepreneur that's, you know, got a business in the 5 to 10 million range, maybe an e-commerce entrepreneur that has a net worth between, you know, or investable assets for, of a couple million dollars. Where do you see opportunity this coming year?
Interesting question. First of all, I think it's a great time to invest or acquire. And one of the things that surprises me is that many entrepreneurs we speak to don't think about making acquisitions themselves. Why is that? Probably going back to my earlier point, they mightn't have boards that give them the confidence to actually do that. The reason why aggregators or roll-ups exist is it's the fastest way to create shareholder value. There are aggregators, there have been aggregators for the last 50 years, right? The largest one, the most successful one is based in Canada called Constellation. It owns 600 brands. It's an incredible story. If done right, aggregation can work, especially if they're led by operators, true operators, as opposed to, you know, investment bankers, geeks like myself, who are into, you know, deals as opposed to operating brands. And I would challenge your entrepreneurs to at least give that some thought. If you own, again, just say a treat pet business for argument's sake, maybe there's a rival that's in a slightly different niche that you could acquire and, you know, double your business. And a 20 million revenue business is going to get a lot more attention from acquirers than a 10 million revenue business is, particularly private equity and small strategics. So I would challenge your listeners to prepare as early as possible, get mentors or boards, and also don't rule out the thought of being slightly aggressive and doing some acquisitions yourself.
Debt markets, the equity markets are, as you mentioned, pretty much shut right now, at least on a more VC institutional level. And a lot of our listeners aren't going out and raising money from those types of institutions anyway. The bigger challenge, I think a lot of people listening, and again, just for, you probably know this, but probably your average listener has a business in the, you know, 7 to low 8-figure range. Debt financing is probably the biggest challenge, especially when they're growing quickly. What do you see the best options for raising debt, you know, looking into 2024 are? What are the options? What do you advise? And what kind of options are people, should they be thinking about, but they're not thinking as much about? Because this is a service you also offer in terms of advisory and helping people with this.
I think my first comment would be bringing together two businesses can be done with paper. You don't necessarily need any financing to get it done, right? Give the seller equity in NewCo and come together to be stronger together. If you do want to acquire it outright, yes, there'll be funding needs. Hopefully the acquirer can bring some equity to the table. In terms of debt, one needs to be creative. Thankfully, interest rates are very likely to go down in 2024. That'll make financing easier. Interestingly, some of the revenue-based funding companies are sort of moving up the chain, so to speak. They're now beginning to offer less high-cost short-term funding and more sort of term loan or other acquisition solutions. And I think you'll see that to continue to develop, particularly, you know, post what happened with some of those firms. So I think it's not easy, but it's going to get easier. Going to get relatively easier for sure. But there's ways to be creative. We're bringing together two aggregators at the moment, and it's a paper deal. There's no money changing hands, but they know they're stronger together. And I think the same rationale can apply to individual brands.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about the difference, a process-based approach to selling your business versus listing your business for sale. I think this is something that has the potential, takes a lot more work, but also has the potential to unlock a lot of value. So can you talk about the benefits to that and when that makes sense to do?
Maybe I come with too much of a Wall Street background, but you know, no large business lists their business for sale on a website. It's just not the way to do it. It's not, if you're sensible and you have a large business, you do not list it on any website. Lots of small businesses do. I get that. It's for the micro businesses, in my view. I think any company with a board or a proper set of advisors will want a more discreet process that's rifle shot instead of machine gun, you know, the way this is all about following the flirt, date, marry approach, having tailored, thinking. I'll give you an example. I'm selling one of my other businesses at the moment, and we're working on the SIM, the confidential information memorandum, and to different types of buyers, we're tailoring the SIM to think about the synergies for those buyers, as opposed to like having, you know, one profile on a website, which is, you know, not thoughtful for the different types of buyers and not detailed enough. So when you're selling a business, do the flirt, date, marry approach. And the best way to ultimately find the right marriage is to think of you being in the shoes of the buyer. What do you want to see? Make it easy for them. When they go to their investment committee, like, just give them everything they need right now. Show them all the synergies. Show them what they can do based on what they already have to take it to the next stage, you know? And listing doesn't do that. Bespoke, intense, thoughtful, hard work and thinking does. And, you know, dialogue.
Talk a little bit, as we're kind of getting close to wrapping up, talk a little bit, if you would, about like the Fortea Group and who you're a good fit for and how, kind of why it would be advantageous for someone with a brand or a business for sale to come to you and how you can help them.
Well, I've always been interested in e-commerce. I did a master's on the topic way back in 1999. I'm showing my age now. It was one of the first masters of its kind. And, you know, since then, I've worked on $20 billion worth of deals around the world. What I get a kick out of doing is working with smart entrepreneurs, helping them crystallize the value in their businesses, whether that's helping them sell the company, raise equity, raise debt. That's all we do at the Fortea Group every day is help entrepreneurs do that. We bring a Wall Street, Morgan Stanley level of service. That's key. So we want to do a small number of bespoke, intense projects every year and help those folk get home runs.
And how does a fee structure differ? Like, a lot of times, I think people listening are kind of accustomed to maybe 10%-ish for a traditional broker approach. When you start getting into the process-based approach, a lower market investment bank like yourself, what does a fee structure look like there for someone?
So there's two types of components, Andrew. There's a commitment fee, upfront commitment fee, and then a success fee. Commitment fee size depends on the size of the business. But it's not that large. It just keeps the lights on back at HQ, frankly. We don't get wealthy from commitment fees. We make our real money through success fees. They can be structured in a variety of ways. So, for example, there could be a base fee for hitting a certain valuation milestone and then increments of 0.5% for every 1x multiple we get above that, as an example. Our fees are never higher than 10x, the 10%, excuse me, because we're doing larger deals. And the other thing I'd say on fees is our fees are deferred. So if the entrepreneur gets 70% upfront and 30% deferred, our fees are paid when he or she gets paid. So we're incentivized to make sure you get transparent, clear, deferred consideration. But we also stay in touch with both the seller and the buyer post the deal to make sure the entrepreneur gets as much cash in the bank account as possible.
So if people want to find more about you, connect, talk about this, get valuations, discuss an engagement. So thefortiagroup.com, that's F-O-R-T-I-A, I believe, fortiagroup.com. Anywhere else they should reach out, or is that the best place?
That's the best place, Andrew. Thank you.
Great. And we're going to take a hard right turn here, completely leaving M&A, finance, geekery, all this stuff. You've got a new app. And this is just something, one question I always ask podcast guests is, what are you excited about right now? And sometimes we weave it in, sometimes we don't. But I thought this was interesting. Talk about Pit Stop. It's a new app that you have, which is completely unrelated to e-commerce or banking. But I thought it was fascinating.
By the time of this podcast going live, yeah, the app will be on the app stores, which is exciting. So I had a health scare about 18 months ago, Andrew, and it was a wake-up call for me to think more about my well-being. And I went looking for an app focused on men's well-being and couldn't find one, which is sort of staggering. As I say, I still pinch myself. Like, there's 7 million apps and there wasn't one focused on men's well-being. There's lots for women, but none for men. So I set about changing that. And Pit Stop is the name of the app where we want to, you know, create this concept of that men should take a pit stop and step back, reflect on their well-being, which can be anything from physical health, mental health, leisure, relationships, career, finance. yeah, it's on the app stores, and the website is takeapitstop.com.
So when you say wellness, that is a very broad term. What was it that, and maybe we can use an example without getting into too much of your details. What were the changes that you wanted to make after you had that health scare? Like, what kind of things did you reprioritize or want to be doing differently? Like, when you were searching for that app, what were you hoping to change in your life post scare?
Yeah, great question. There's so much learnings that I've had over the years. So I wanted to initially, because it was a health scare, I focused on the physical side of things. So I did things like give up coffee, do a more paleo diet, started to do more fasting, started to do a morning routine, an evening routine, listened to amazing podcasters like Huberman Labs out of Stanford, Dr. Atiya, the leading longevity expert, read a lot of very relevant books. I worked too hard, so I did a big focus on productivity. And, you know, it's endless. I've learned so much. Let me try and give you a simple example. You know, a really simple one is when you wake up, the sooner you put your eyes into natural sunlight, the sooner it starts your circadian rhythm, which is going to help you sleep better that night. Right. So that sounds so simple. But when you start building up and adding, you know, 50 of those types of things into your day, you're going to improve your lifestyle and your well-being. So the app is designed to help people learn about all these things and try and make it a habit.
Well, the coffee, did you give it up because of the caffeine impact on your body even in the morning, or was it something else that you gave it up for?
It was a recommendation by a doctor because the issue I had was heart related, and I was asked to give that up. So I now drink 2 cups of tea a day. I try and have my last one by 1 or 2 p.m. Because 10% of caffeine stays in your body 10 hours later, you know, roughly. So, yeah, trying to listen and learn all the time.
It's interesting. I had a weird thing. I had COVID. Well, it was probably 2 years ago now, year and a half ago, within the last couple of years, and was relatively minor. But the weird thing was I had some weird heart issues as a result of it. And so I kind of nothing insane, but enough to go like get checked out and learned all the stuff about the heart. Like, I never realized stress has a major impact on your heart. Caffeine can play a major impact on your heart. Like, of course, diet and other things can, but the stress and the caffeine,
yeah.
I had no idea. And so for part of it, like, I still love coffee and I'll drink regular occasionally, but our morning brew, this is going to be blasphemous to so many coffee, you know, people out there, but drink decaf, because if I drink three or four cups and it's caffeinated, I'm a hot mess by 2 p.m. You know, I just fall off a cliff.
Yeah, yeah. And there's some interesting stats to show that you should wait until 90 minutes after waking up to drink your first coffee. That's better for your body, and then helps you not need as much coffee throughout the day. You know, there's all this information out there. To your heart point, there's a great study in Finland showing that if you take a sauna 3 to 4 times a week, you can reduce heart issues by 40%. And similar with cold water therapy or, you know, plunge pools. So there's all this information out there. Frankly, it should have been taught to us at school. All of the above. Society is starting a little bit, maybe at sort of, you know, high school level. But there's so much to learn. It's hard to keep up. And the app is going to try and help folks, you know, learn and adapt and evolve.
Yeah, I'm excited to check it out. How do you, I mean, I could be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing you haven't launched an app before. So how do you go out and something that you've done in the last year or so, did you find a co-founder? Did you hire an agency to help you build this? Like, how did you, and I mean, you're running an investment bank full time, so it's not like you've got 40 hours a week to do this. I'd love to hear the broad strokes.
It's a great question. And, this is my fourth startup, and I become more mature as I age and as each startup happens, and more learned. From day one, when I realized there was something interesting here, I decided that I wasn't the right person to run it. And the reason is I've never run an app. If I did it, I'd be learning on the job. And frankly, for my well-being, it wouldn't be good to run another business. But I'm putting the A team together, frankly. I'm putting together folks that have built and sold apps. Everyone who comes to work for the business has pretty much worked at an app. And we found a great agency in Finland who's built the MVP. So, yeah, I'm chairman, Andrew. I'm not a CEO. I have a great board. Going back to mentors that we were talking about earlier, I put together a great board and I put together a great advisory panel. So, for example, on the advisors, we have a leading longevity expert. We have a leading behavioral change expert, because if you can't change behavior and they never change habits and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's about recognizing your strengths and weaknesses and bringing in people to complement those. And then motivating, having a clear vision and mission and North Star, and motivating people towards that.
You've talked a lot about great guidance and mentorship, which is something I don't think it gets talked about a lot. Do you have any advice for someone? I think the hardest part is people who are earlier in their career and need that oftentimes maybe don't approach looking for a mentor the right way, because oftentimes it's kind of a tricky thing, right? You walk into someone, ask them to be your mentor. A, it's a little awkward. B, a good mentorship, sometimes I have seen them work where you have someone who's just purely investing into someone else. But oftentimes the way it works is often when it's a reciprocal relationship as well. Do you have any thoughts on someone who's early in their career, even in the middle of their career, for finding a great mentor in a way that makes sense for everyone involved?
I'll give you an example. At my data business, Eagle Alpha, many years ago, about 10 years ago now, our CTO said, or came up with some suggestions, and they were local suggestions for a tech advisor. And I say, no, stop. We need to think big here. Who would you really like globally to be your advisor? And he said, the CTO of Twitter. And I said, okay, leave it with me. I pinged him on LinkedIn. I'm based in Ireland. 2 weeks later, he was drinking Guinness with me and the CTO here in Ireland. So you never know. If you write that LinkedIn email in the right way, and say, if you have a subject line saying your advice, please. Lots of people like talking and giving advice, and if you're onto something really interesting, and you respect them and will offer them, obviously appropriate compensation, then not everyone's going to respond, but you should get a good hit rate. So I'd be cheeky. I'd literally go on LinkedIn and go, right, who are my top 10 awesome people that I would want that can make the difference in my business? And I'd approach them all. What do you got to lose?
Yeah, I love it. That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at Ecommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.